This is the Wednesday afternoon, the 16th of March, an interview with Dr. Robert Hyatt and Beth Hyatt's wife. We're just going to discuss a number of areas about Dr. Hyatt's career and just Beth Hyatt's and her involvement in Alaska. Dr. Hyatt, could you briefly recap kind of your major research? Because I was just going over your vita and saw there perhaps a change in biology and centering on bird life from the early part to more orientation toward marine biology and that kind of thing.
Well, I was trained, that is, I finished my doctorate in the marine biological area, actually working on West Coast crabs, which made me feel a little closer to the crab industry in Alaska than otherwise might have done. But I finished in 1941, which was still in the depths of the Depression, and the only position I could find that I really wanted was in Montana, Montana State University, and that's a little bit removed from marine environment, so I switched over to ornithology, which had been an earlier interest of mine. And worked on that for a couple of years and published a number of papers there, particularly in the upland game birds of the state of Montana. And then moved on to Hawaii. The war broke out just about shortly after I got there, and as a result, the students pretty much dwindled away, and we ended up teaching primarily air cadets. So the long-range view at that particular early period in the war wasn't very clear, and an occasion arose to take a position in Hawaii in marine biology, and so I dropped everything in Montana and we moved to Hawaii. We had no idea at that time how long-range this kind of thing would be, or even whether or not the war would enable us to go much further. So happened that we ended up staying 26 years in Hawaii, and that time went from an assistant professorship, which is the way I started, finally to senior professor and to dean of the graduate school and director of research, and finally vice president for academic affairs, and the last couple of years as acting president of the university. So, in effect, we spent our career in Hawaii, and I retired, taking advantage of early retirement so I could do something else for 10 years in 1969.
I seem to notice a beginning of a mixture between your research activities and academic activities, and I'm just wondering if you'd like to comment on that, and you're drawing into research and still involved in teaching for quite a few years.
Yes, at Berkeley, where I did my graduate work, we had very few research professors per se. Almost everybody taught and did research. They're expected to be scholars. They're expected to be scholarly teachers, scholarly researchers. And I suppose that colored my attitudes about how a university faculty member ought to function. And when I went to Montana, I mixed up the two. And when I went to Hawaii, I proceeded to do the same, and I brought people onto the staff there over the years who wanted to do that kind of mixed teaching research activity. Consequently, we built up in Hawaii, I think, the finest marine biological faculty then existing in the nation, and that still persists today as a very strong faculty. There, of course, we didn't work on birds very much, but rather turned our attention then to the mid-Pacific, tropical mid-Pacific. And I switched my emphasis then particularly to the tuna fishes, which are the principal commercial fishes there. They are to Hawaii what salmon is to Alaska. their bait fishes because they catch them with bait fish, working on the biology of those fishes because that was the limiting factor in terms of the tuna catch. Then later on, I turned my attention to coral reefs when we began to become more interested in the Marshall Islands, which this occurred right after the Bikini bomb tests, in which I participated as a young researcher, donating my time at that time, just for the experience of being there. After that time, I then took over the direction of the Atomic Energy Commission's laboratory at Niwetok and held that role for about 20 years while still participating fully at the University of Hawaii. So there are a number of things that occasion shifts in the research interest, but once we went to Hawaii, it stayed right with the marine area. And as I say, we had people right straight along in all of our developments there, in the many kinds of research institutes that were developed during my regime. Almost all of them were 100% teaching and research posts. We just mixed them up. And I think that's the way they should go, and that explains one of the reasons why I made change here when I came.
But I'd like to explore that more because I talked with Rodman Paul, I think he's at the University of California, mm-hmm. Caltech, a historian, and I guess he and I were discussing the evolution of this kind of a system here versus the outgrowth, how it's grown in other institutions. You mentioned you retired early from Hawaii. 26 years almost seemed like a full career anyway without early retirement, considering Alaska. Earlier, even earlier than 26 years. What really interested the both of you in coming to Alaska? It looked like you were kind of footloose and fancy free at that time. I'm just wondering why you, what were the challenges?
I don't know whether I should start in on that, since I guess I probably swung the balance. as I say, I started my career in Montana, right in Bozeman, which is right in the center of the beautiful Rockies. And that left a lasting impression on me. And after 26 years in Hawaii, where you also have a different kind of beauty, but not the pine and fir forests and the lakes and all that sort of thing that I remembered so well. The opportunity to come to Alaska, I'm sure, recall perhaps these latent ideas I had of getting back to the Rockies someday. And this was a very, very strong attraction in terms of, you might say, life values or quality of life values. You have to remember that we were living in Japan at that time. And I had hoped to spend 10 years after my early retirement in the diplomatic service, and we had spent 3.5, but at the time that I was called and asked I'd be interested in this position in Alaska. Having left academia, I thought for good, I told him I wasn't really sure that I was interested, but I would certainly give it some thought, and I think Bess can vouch for the fact that after about a week or so of discussing the possibilities, the choice really was presented to me of going to London, which was the finest post in our diplomatic service at that time, outside of Tokyo, or coming to Alaska. And as a result of Alaska's great attraction and the attraction of being able to try to build a statewide system in a growing state was just more than I could overcome in relation to our great interest in going back to England, where we'd spend a year, and wanted to do that very much too. I don't know if Beth can add to that reasons.
It was a very difficult decision to make. And at one time, it was so difficult that I remember Bob saying, "I don't know what to do, but I'll just take the first one and go." And what if they didn't both come at once? So I must say we stayed up until about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning discussing it, but really discussing it from his point of view, because at this time I was not working. And our children were all grown, married with their own families. So my situation was that we were free, and I had some wonderful experiences traveling in Japan. I had these years in Hawaii, and it was going to be his profession that he wanted to be at that time. I must admit, though, after that wonderful year we had at sabbatical in Europe, which is 7 to 8 years, when families with us and we traveled all over the continent and to England and Scotland, and I was just 18 after. But I also remembered the first time that we flew over Alaska. And I must say I was impressed with those, shall we say, magnificent mountains and the scenery that I saw. So it didn't matter to me, and I felt that it was just like, you know, we made it, here we are.
I'd just like to go back for a second in terms of your lifestyle in Hawaii versus the lifestyle up here. You know, fairly radical change in climate and the other things that go along with it.
Yes. And most people will ask that same question because, of course, it doesn't seem very long when one thinks of 26 years in Hawaii and then 4 years in Japan, but actually, making the break from Hawaii was perhaps the most traumatic for me. The reason being that we had lived there, and for a wife and mother, who had been there for 26 years. And at the time we made a decision then to go into the diplomatic service and leave, we had friends of 20 odd years. We had an older boy with his wife and one child, and our youngest boy there in Hawaii. And we were leaving, not they.
Yeah.
So this was rather traumatic, I must say. But once we went to Japan, and once I bought more than just a sweater, and that's all I had for warmth from Hawaii. And Japan's winters can be cold. We needed some traveling up into the Japanese Alps. Therefore, we needed more warm clothing. Consequently, I was prepared somewhat for a climate that was a little different. Not as much as I perhaps as I found, but I still had some warm clothes. And then I didn't mind the change coming here. I felt as though it was an adventure because we had already made the big break, which to me was the one from home. Therefore, having something new coming into new surroundings with new adventures was, I think, a very rewarding experience.
Dr. Hyatt, what drew your interest into the diplomatic corps as a science advisor?
Well, of course, my entire career, except for the period from about 63 on, when I became dean of graduate school and whatnot, was in science. Started out that way, went through that way, and I knew that the State Department, I served a year in the Office of Naval Research, London office, and I knew the State Department had just that year, this was 1957-58, had started up its own science diplomatic corps, and the first one was stationed in London, so I was sort of acquainted with that system when it started. And when we decided to look for a new career for 10 years, Hawaii had just passed a 55-year-old retirement plan. Prior to that time, you had to be 65 to participate. Just a year before they passed this plan, I had become 55. And the magic numbers are 55 and 25, 55 years old and 25 years service. I had it right on the button almost at that time. It wasn't done for my sake, of course, but I just happened to luck out in it. So I thought, well, this is the proper time after 26 years in one institution to get a little restless and want to see if there's something else important in the world. And so I contacted the Department of State office that handled all the scientific attaches and counselors abroad, and said that if something opened up in Japan, I would be willing to go. And then I chose Japan because after all those years in Hawaii, we sort of felt closer to the Japanese scientific endeavor than any other place because we had so much contact back and forth. Well, it just so happened that a job was opening up in 3 or 4 months in Japan, and so they indicated that I should get ready to go, which I did, and I went there about the first or second of January 1970. It was right in the beginning of the year, and became there at the embassy called a counselor for science and technology. Embassies, diplomatic service has ranks just like universities have ranks, and their ambassadors and ministers, the next rank, counselors are the next, third rank. And so this was a top State Department job, and I just felt I was very fortunate to be able to serve that way. And in 4 years, I was able to put together the American and Japanese science enterprise in that cooperative nature in a very effective way, and so effective I'm still chairman of the U.S.-Japan committee that runs that show. So we enjoyed this, and we learned a lot. I think more about Japan than about the United States by far. And that I think has stood me in quite good standing in the international scene, even the national scene as it relates to Asia.
Mm-hmm. Let me move on then in terms of your coming to the University of Alaska and some of the major achievements that we've kind of mentioned or put on the agenda. I guess what I'm interested in exploring a little bit more is the academic and research, the integration. It seems to me that some of the research institutes here have been kind of plunked on campus without being an outgrowth of the faculty. So we have research institutes that are kind of spinning by themselves. And have you cared to comment in terms of your thought on that relationship?
I wasn't here, of course, when these research institutes were established. All of them were established before my time, and then the new ones established since. And they were established in different ways, of course. The Geophysical Institute was put here as a federal project. It had nothing to do with the University of Alaska, really, except the University of Alaska was a nice place to set the plant down and have the people interact with the university people. Later on, it became part of the university, and thus was a model that we attempted to follow in Hawaii. It's an apart geophysical institute. Didn't quite go the same way because by that time the government had no more use for operating such institutes, but instead they gave us the money and we developed it ourselves in Hawaii. But the Alaska Institute was well known at that time, and we tried to pattern ours, as I say, after it at the federal level, federal congressional level. Starting an institute of that sort, totally independent from the university, and then later on trying to integrate it is not the easiest thing in the world to do. People get used to being relatively autonomous. Autonomy is a word that's kicked around much too much, really, on the university campus, but that's what it was, a pretty autonomous institute. Well, that then served as a kind of a model for a number of others that were established with either state legislative authority or without it, where the funds mostly were derived from federal grants and contracts and only a small amount put in by the state. And as a result, in the 50s and up at least about to the end of the 60s, we had this great growth of these institutes on campus, all growing in the same pattern as the Geophysical Institute in terms of being quite separate from the rest of the university enterprise. When I came here, it was very obvious, even on my first visit, to review the university and be reviewed by the selection committee, that there were two classes of faculty on the campus. And I thought this was a kind of a vicious situation, because we had a very envious teaching faculty, and you might say almost the obverse in the research group, a kind of a snobbishness that didn't make for getting them together very readily. Now, one of the things I thought I would do first when I came here was get rid of that, if I could. And that was a major reason for the reorganization of this campus, to try to get these two groups integrated in such a way that they had to talk together. I realized this wouldn't come about completely in just a year or two, but I think given 10 years or so, there will be an almost total integration. We'll have one faculty group and not two groups, each sort of backbiting at the other. The research people were largely put on 12 months contracts, the teaching group on 9 months contracts, with correspondingly, of course, less salary. This made for very hard feelings among the two. As a matter of fact, I've never, in all the camps that I've ever been on, I've never seen anything like this. So I brought onto the campus some acquaintances who were to investigate this for me. People here on the campus didn't know that these people were doing that, just to find out what these relationships were. Now, these people were distinguished people whom others could relate to very well, but they didn't know why they were here. And it soon became apparent to me, through their advice, that the impression that I had when I first came here, largely because I suppose the teaching faculty were the most vocal, was that these research people wouldn't cooperate, and they wouldn't give them an opportunity to research, and they were really holding things back. The results of the interviews by people I had come on the campus showed just the reverse, that it was the teaching faculty who didn't want the research people participating in teaching and used every means they could to keep them from doing so. Now, this of course was something that I didn't talk about publicly, but just set about quietly to see if I couldn't overcome through some other mechanism. And as I say, that's why we tried to organize the colleges, so-called, into different groups, so that the researchers and the teachers would all be in the same administrative unit, so that indeed they could possibly be employed part-time on research, part-time in teaching, and so on, and get back to that thing that we'd done back in Hawaii 25 years earlier and never had any problem that way because of it. And most other universities did the same thing. I don't know, as I say, this University of Alaska was totally different in that development. Now, it may have been the isolation up here at that time. There wasn't all that much communication. It may have been the fact that money was more readily available to federal sources, that these people could move rapidly, whereas the teaching group that had to depend upon state appropriations didn't really have the same opportunities to be supported. There are probably complex reasons for its development. But I would say that the integration of the academic, the teaching research faculties, I felt was the highest priority thing on this campus. Not developing more institutes and that sort of thing. Not going out after more money. They already had enough, really, to do what they needed to do. But to try to get them together. And then a little later on, that led into another phase of this, is to try to get them to program their work as useful as they could, and make it useful as they could to Alaska, as contrasted to what I just call scientific hotels, where anybody with a research grant or contract could come up and get a place to work, and they would consider him part of the faculty, and so on. Whether or not his work really related to the university or Alaska or anything else didn't make much difference. We had a lot of that going on, still going on. here. And my feeling was that this ought to be programmed a little more so that we actually sought people that would fill in gaps in programs rather than to seek outstanding names or people who could always go get a grant just to fill out a faculty. So these are issues that are difficult to solve in many ways. They take a lot of effort, and they take a lot of attitudinal changes that were most difficult to bring about on this campus.
I was wondering if one of the difficulties was that the institute could develop a subject area that didn't relate directly to, say, the undergraduate and the master's degree program. Something in marine science that really didn't have a strong program below it. It seemed to me that the faculties were, you could bring in faculty for a research institute that was generated by the program itself, like as you mentioned in Hawaii, where you got the money and developed a program out of the academic department.
Yeah. I think one of the problems that we didn't really face in Hawaii, and you did face in Alaska, was you really didn't have a very large student body. When I left Hawaii, we had, I guess, 22,000 students on the main campus. Well, that contrasted with 3,000 here when I came. Now, if you don't have a large enough student body, you really don't have the opportunity to enlarge your staff on the basis of the need for teaching. Neither do you have the opportunity to put a lot of these research people to teaching, you know, because the need isn't there. So, as I say, these things are a little complex, and if we had developed the research institutes on this campus on the basis of, let's might say, departmental structure and departmental staffing, they never would have developed them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think they would have been a critical mass, say. Certainly not in geophysics. Where would you find a critical mass of geophysics in the undergraduate level?
Right.
Even in oceanography, you just wouldn't find it. You would now in wildlife management, agriculture, some of these areas. But in some of the more esoteric areas, which lend themselves more readily to graduate study and research, we wouldn't have made it here. Just wouldn't have. So there was a good reason for having research faculty who didn't teach. But the thing that I was concerned about is that this two faculty mechanism was so all pervasive that it didn't allow any interaction to speak up. Now, there was a little. Some of the institutes would hire teaching faculty in the summer to do a research job or something of that sort. But I don't call that joint use of faculty. That just sort of compensating some of these people for the lack of a 12-month appointment.
Mrs. Hyatt, you were involved in one way Hawaiian lifestyle and in Japan, and then all of a sudden you came here as the wife of the president. How was that change in terms of position or role? How did you feel to that?
Well, Paul, I would say that because Bob was into administration from the time he was, let's say, even the graduate school. From that time on, we both became Long Royal administrators. Activities for me and work for him. So that I had been teaching up to that point. I taught for 12 years at a Punahou school in Hawaii, and at the same time raised the three children. Consequently, I stopped teaching when our oldest was married, and then we began to do more together, traveling, administrative, entertaining, etc. So that, let's say from that time, which was in the late 50s on, I had been used to being in a situation where I would be handling groups of people. Even though before that, as the wife of a marine biologist, our life had been casual for two reasons. First of all, being out in the open water on the shores was always a casual experience. And then for us to choose a home, it was also on the shore. We lived on the beach section of HR family in this particular home, 17 miles from the campus for 19 years. Mm-hmm. So consequently, it had been a very casual life, bare feet and all. But we did some entertaining there, but it was always very casual. But the gradual approach into administration, of course, turned things a little bit the other way. Not so much that it changed my attitude. I'm still a rather casual person and like informal things and fond of people and like spontaneous entertainment as well as I do the plan. But because we had done this for so many years and because we did then indeed go into the residence also at the University of Hawaii, and then from there, as you know, into Japan, and embassy work requires a great deal of let's say, coordination between the ambassador, the American embassy, all the other foreign embassies, and the Japanese. So that we had larger numbers of people, I guess, really, at our home in Japan than I even had here. So that I was used to it, and used to planning for the whole thing. So coming here and doing that particular thing was not unusual for me. I must say, there are times where anybody, any woman, I think, who is serving in this kind of role, feels somewhat close to dinner coat. I don't appreciate the term fishbowl, because you don't feel that your life is completely your own. But then there are moments like that for everyone, and this you expect when you go into a role like this. And I went along with Bob on his decision to do this, so therefore I expected that particular thing. And the work itself was not that different.
Less degree of personal, I don't mean freedom, but ability to move and do your own thing.
No, I'd say, yes, no, I should take that back. Perhaps the place where I had more opportunity to do my own thing was in Japan. And then I went as far as I could go into all sorts of things. And of course, I would say the size of the city, the ease of travel, the climate. Perhaps more conducive to this kind of life, so that I could take off, for instance, from my home in Tokyo, and in 10 minutes, no one, and I mean no one, know where I was. So that if I wanted to explore a little village here and there, or do some shopping in the wholesale areas, or go to one of the many, many museums or musical entertainment areas to explore the culture of Japan, I did, and that was one of the, shall we say, enriching parts of my life there. I directed a lecture series while I was in Japan through the College Women's Club. I didn't do the lecturing, but I planned for it. It was open to the public, but it was done primarily by Japanese who were, in areas relating to Japan, such as the arts and the sciences. And 10 lectures, which the public paid, so it was my responsibility. But doing this and securing the lectures over a period of a year gave me so many leads that I hadn't already discovered that I felt as though I could live in Japan forever and still not find out all the information I needed to know.
It's a nice feeling.
Yes, it was a nice feeling.
Dr. Hai, you were mentioning the developing or integrating the academic and research faculties as part of the organization. Perhaps you might like to discuss how you saw the concept of a statewide system and how you began to bring the university to this, say, decentralized system.
Well, Paul, let me just step maybe one step behind that idea. When I came here to look over the university and talk a little bit about it. Obviously, I didn't grasp everything that needed to be grasped at that time. Later on, we'll maybe talk about the financial problem. That's something I wasn't even told about. But the point is that I did grasp two things. One, that the morale of the faculty had to be changed somehow. That, and I've already spoken to that in relation to the vicious two class system of the faculty. But going more deeply into this, and particularly working with the university assembly, I discovered that the conditions of employment were not very clear for faculty members. We had no salary schedule. We didn't have any job descriptions, I mean, in terms of what each rank should really be, promotion, tenure, all these things were a little bit hazy. The salaries, of course, were horribly low. I think we're down about somewhere within the lowest of the 10th percentile of comparable institution salary levels in the country. And furthermore, the system didn't seem to have any direction as to where it was going. We had a development in Anchorage. Nobody was quite sure what it was supposed to be. The community college was there and was battling the main campus up here at the time. And so I had to think very quickly as to what is it we're going to do to try to guide the university. And one of the first things was to improve this faculty morale. And we did this, I think, at least we made efforts. I'm not sure we improved it all that much, but certainly we got the salaries up. They're now at least competitive. And particularly those people who've been around a long time are doing very well in relation to their compatriots in the lower 48. We started the work on the academic development plan, which was to give the system some kind of form. So just a group of discrete units all sort of making it on their own in their little communities, I felt that we needed to have some kind of direction. And so the academic development plan was intended to do that, and I think it did. When I came here, there was no indication that we were going to have three major centers of education of four-year sense, graduate sense. There is now. This was developed in the academic development plan that Anchorage won for Fairbank. Already was one in Juneau. Would be one in sort of an abridged fashion, some certain programs that were especially desirable there. The community colleges had no particular role other than to, in some cases, try to meet the what they conceived to be the needs of a community in which they were located. In other cases, particularly down in the Southeast, I couldn't detect that they were meeting any needs that need to be met. They seem to have been established by school districts in the early days and sort of just existed. So one of the things we tried to do in that academic development plan was one, to get a system out of it and to make the university as a whole relate to Alaska, relate to Alaskans. And these were sort of the guiding principles under which I started to work here. I think the route maps are pretty well laid out. We're going to have to do some more work on the details now, and this has to be done really on each campus, unless there's some radical change in the fact that we're going to have three regional main campuses. That has been set. Again, only details need to be completed. I don't think that, given the nature of this state, the regionalization that's going to be obvious and long-lasting, that can be changed. I just don't think that's in the works. So developing this system required, as I say, a plan, and that academic development plan, I think, was an excellent one. I don't know as good a one anywhere else in the United States in terms of laying out what each unit ought to be and what each major coherent area of study ought to be throughout the state. So in that plan, we not only have laid out the special programs, special emphases for the three main campuses, but we've also laid out special emphases for most of the community colleges. Give them some distinction in their own right over and above just meeting their community needs, like the petroleum technology program in Kenai, for example, or the fishery technology program in Kodiak. In the Southeast, hopefully developing their marine career programs for vessel repair, motor repair, things of this sort, and training for the ferry system. These are things that that one wouldn't put just any old place in the system, but by some judicious selection of areas where they are most meaningful, these will give the community colleges and the people that are involved with them enthusiasm. They're doing something nobody else is, and that's what we've been trying to do. I think it's got to be kept up and needs to be worked on consistently. That's, in fact, that's one of the reasons I'm sort of interested in moving into this marine science affairs program, because I think I can work on these things and get them going. But they take a lot of nurturing.
Mm-hmm. I guess I skipped an earlier question in terms of guiding philosophy or principle, but I think it's perhaps coming out of relating the university's research and academic programs not only to the needs of the state, but to the needs of the particular communities that they're in. Is this what you would say?
Yeah, that's right. A major university is going to have to be like almost any other university at the undergraduate level. There'll be very few programs that would be exclusively the jurisdiction of one unit. And that's what we've said, that Anchorage and Fairbanks would both have comprehensive undergraduate programs. But when it comes to graduate programs, then we can begin to make the selection. A person wants to go into geophysics or marine sciences and that sort of thing, he'll come to Fairbanks. They want to go into health-related fields or business and that sort of thing, they may very well go to Fairbanks, to Anchorage. So these are the major distinctions that we have to make, and I think the only ones that can be made in a reasonable fashion.
One of the other developments I think we've seen is an upgraded computer center and a capability there. Was this, I think you were involved with that in Hawaii too, weren't you?
Yes. Of course, I was in Hawaii long enough to start from the desk calculator on up to the IBM Model 75. So we just about ran the gamut during my time there. But when I was director of research, it became obvious that we simply had to get into computers, and we arranged to somehow get $50,000 and got an IBM 650. That was the first real computer of any size. Of course, midget, by the way, what it can do compared to the one we have here now, but that was all a vacuum tube outfit. Everything went wrong with it that could go wrong every day. It wasn't what you'd call a reliable machine, but it certainly gave our program a big boost. So we finally ended up then going on to larger computers. When I came here, we had a medium-sized computer on campus that was developed pretty largely on the strength of the research program. Then as the business operations became more computerized, they gradually moved in on it as well. But the model that we had was not at all adequate for a system. It had no opportunity to develop timeshare, and we couldn't hook up Anchorage or Juneau or any of the community colleges to it. And that meant we either had to go to a major central unit to which we could hook the others in at much less expense, or to set up separate computers all over the lot. And having had some experience with separate computers being set up, I decided that wasn't the way to go. Everybody wants a different one. Like some people want Fords and some Chevrolets and some Plymouth. They all want different models of computers. And it's very difficult to talk them out of it. And the computer companies thrive on that kind of thing. And they make deals back and forth. So you'd end up with a University of Alaska system with maybe half a dozen different kinds of computers, none of which would talk to each other, and we'd have just utter chaos. That's the reason we decided to go with a system that was large enough and capable of being expanded, added to, so that the various nodes or terminals that are required for input and printout could simply be installed wherever they're needed. And I think the computer system we have is a good one. As far as hardware goes, it's good. The computer users committee, headed by Dan Swift now has reported that there are more faculty and students on that computer than they had anticipated for even a year ahead of this particular point in time. So what's happened is we are getting the whole university on that computer. Now, the computer's been ridiculed a great deal, largely because of the business operations, but it's not the computer. The computer only does what you tell it to. The business operations are fouled up because of the software that the computer has to use, the programs and so on. So I'd say that the computer center that we have and its operation is very good. And I don't know of any better ones of this size anyplace.
I know we have, I think, three terminals in the reserve room for student use, and now we're trying to put one in downstairs for administrative. Yeah.
But you see, with the old computer, you couldn't have done that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. In this age of computers, this gives students, and particularly, an opportunity to really get on them and get acquainted with them, and I think it's a great thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think, how much more time do you have, right? 3 minutes?